When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I don't think when you're talking about books that you can be completely objective. I don't think that's actually possible for anyone. Fantasy is the literature of the imagination, much more so than any other genre. I'm a very proud defender of fantasy.
The ultimate goal of sci-fi is to make you believe that it's not our world, but it's one that could be our world.
It has
one
to be
day.
Probable. So it's impossible versus probable.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Two to Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm your other host, Richard.
Today, we have a special guest, Philip Chase, here to talk with us about good writing versus bad writing. And the reason we have Philip on, one, love his channel. Go check him out, Philip Chase, on YouTube. He has a great BookTube channel. He's also an author of the Eden trilogy, all three books out. First book is The Way of Eden. And not just that, he's a professor with a PhD in English literature. He teaches writing, medieval literature, fantasy literature. He's the perfect person to talk about what makes good prose, dialogue, the craft of writing. Philip Chase, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Richard and Austin. That was a very lovely introduction, and I really appreciate the invitation, and I'm excited to talk about prose, which is, I'm sure, everybody's favorite topic to talk about, right? On YouTube, right?
It's real clickbaity. It's just nice and salient. Yeah. And why is it every time, like, I introduce somebody, they have to always thank Richard first? I don't get it. I know, but I don't like it. I want to sit over there. I like
the seating order was deliberate.
I feel like you have the first seat. It's like a talk show, and then you just got it.
Yep, left to right. That's how you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, I'm very, very happy to have you on, Philip, because we've been wanting to do a video talking specifically about prose and what we like about it, what we think makes good prose versus subpar, and ultimately. Yeah. We're two schmucks with a YouTube channel who haven't written anything. We've just read some books. And so really happy to have you on. A little bit more expertise can maybe say what we're thinking or say what we have deep in our subconscious in an eloquent way.
Absolutely.
Oh, I'll try my best to live up to that. It is actually interesting that a lot of people think they're not interested in prose, but I think that people, if they kind of were to learn a little more about it, would find that they're actually very interested in it. And without prose, there's no story. So it's just so, so important, actually. And hopefully that will emerge during our discussion.
I mean, when you teach these kind of courses, do you introduce it with a certain kind of your intro lecture of convincing people why it's that important? Is there ever that? Because I'm sure some people in your classes are like, I got to take this. Maybe it's an elective or gen ed. I've been in those classes. By the way, I'd love your class. I mean, hey, if you have extra spots, let us know. But how do you reach out to those students of yours that aren't as interested in the topic?
Yeah, that's a great question, actually. And that's the majority of my students, in fact. So it is something that I do need to do. I think the key thing is to simply demystify and explain why it's important and why they might actually be more interested in it than they might have previously thought. So that just involves, for me, in many ways, I think my job is to just lead somebody to a place where they can further appreciate something like prose. And it's up to them, really, to, you know, you can lead a horse to water and all that. But it is something that I think confuses a lot of people. The word prose itself is often, I think you'll hear people, and I've heard people with PhDs do this, by the way, so this is not at all, I hope doesn't come across as disparaging, but I hear sometimes people will say prose, an author's prose are, whereas it really should be an author's prose is, because it's singular, right? It's a word that is just very confusing to people, and a lot of that has to do with where it originally came from and what it meant hundreds of years ago, as opposed to what it means kind of in many people's minds today. So there's a lot of confusion around the word, but I think once people understand what it is, they'll be able to not only appreciate it, but understand why they actually like some of their favorite authors. What is it about those authors that really speaks to them? Once you understand what a particular author's prose, what you can articulate, you know, what that author's prose is like, it'll give you, I think, a greater appreciation for what that author does. So it's actually a fun topic. I think once students understand it, it gets to be more fun.
Can you explain to us then, to jump right into that, what did prose mean in historical past, and what do you believe that it really means today? Because I understand a lot of things can go into someone's prose. We could maybe say like the dialogue, the style, the in all honesty, just what perspective is the prose in? Like, how would you exactly define it? What counts, what wouldn't count as an author's prose?
Great question. And you brought up a couple of important points, and we're going to get to those. I think in particular, a lot of people do, when they say prose, what they probably really mean is style. And we can talk easily about style. If you listen to a certain composer or a certain band of music, you get a feel for, you know, even if you listen to a song of theirs that you've never heard before, you hear it on the radio for the first time, you probably know, oh, that's that band that I like, or that's that composer that I love, because you've got a feel for that composer's style. Authors are similar. And we can tell an author's style often through such things as diction, which is word choice. What kinds of words does an author kind of like? And you get a sense of that. You get a sense of an author favors a certain kind of imagery that you begin to associate with that author. So there are these hallmarks of that author's writing that you get to know once you read more and more of your favorite author or favorite authors. So yeah, that's style. I think a lot of people do mean style when they might say, oh, I don't really care much about prose, or I'm not a prose snob. You hear that a lot. I'm not a prose snob, right? What people mean, I think, is that I am not that interested in the esoteric study of this particular, you know, style of an author or something like that. But prose is actually a much broader thing. Originally, it comes from the Latin. Always, if you want to impress people, you use Latin, right?
Right? English is confusing because we have Germanic and Latin roots, and our words are just jumbled up, and it's a word salad, essentially.
English is the craziest language in the world. Yeah, it sure is. But when you want to impress people, you whip out the Latin words, right? But prose, it simply meant at one time, everyday speech or language. And is a distinction that was made in much older times, because most storytelling done, certainly in times of pre-literacy, we're pretty sure most storytelling was done in a poetic form. So the main vehicle for storytelling, like think of like the Iliad and the Odyssey and Beowulf and those old epics and those much older forms of storytelling. Poetry was the main vehicle for storytelling. Another old form of literature, we say literature when things start getting written down, right? So when literacy enters the equation, we're talking about literature. So at a certain point, literacy enters the equation, but a lot of times these cultures like the Iliad and the Odyssey and Beowulf and all the Aeneid and so many other great stories of the past, they simply took the traditions that came out of these oral formulaic cultures. And when literacy came along, they started writing it down. And it took a poetic form, because, you know, bards would be chanting this. They use rhyme or alliteration or other poetic features to you know, carry the story along. So another ancient form of storytelling is drama, which, again, has its own rituals. It has its own format. And prose is actually the new kid on the block, relatively speaking, prose literature. So we have these three distinctions. You have poetry, you have drama, and you have prose literature. And when I say literature, that does, by the way, prose literature can include nonfiction and fiction as well. But what it simply means is, in contrast to poetry, so when you think of poetry, and obviously this is, all these are very imperfect definitions because poetry has really just changed a lot. By the way, I wanted to mention too, there's a great video on YouTube on this topic made by a friend of mine named AP Canavan, who his channel is A Critical Dragon. And he addresses this all in like 20 minutes or so in a very nice, I think, clear manner. But anyway, that aside, yeah, if you look at what prose is, it's not like poetry where you have these certain flourishes, these rhyming, you have a lot of metaphors and similes. It's not that prose can't do those things sometimes, but it tends not to do it. It tends to mimic more the everyday language, right? So prose is basically to try to articulate a definition that we can work with here. It's the words on a page in literature that uses the rules of everyday language. So the words on the page in literature that uses the rules of everyday language. That's not to say that it just imitates speech, because if it perfectly imitated speech, you'd have all these awkward pauses and uhs and ahs and unfinished thoughts and, you know, all of that. But to a greater degree, it does tend to use the rules of everyday speech. In contrast to poetry and drama, which are much more ritualized, have certain formats, like a sonnet, right? You know, I could articulate the same idea in poetry and do the same thing in prose, and you would know right away which one is a poem and which is prose. They might be saying the same thing, but I'm using poetic language in the one case and prose on the other. Does that make sense?
That does.
Definitely.
Now, that does bring to mind, though, something on the idea of purple prose and the idea of like this, the pretentious nature of like, I'm a prose snob. And you, is this kind of the idea that, thinking of Shakespeare, Shakespeare at the time it was written is people at that time would have a better understanding that it was, I know Shakespeare made up a lot of words, but at the time he was using words that were common for the day, that it was more common that at the time, where nowadays we'd say, oh wow, it's really purple language,
right?
So is kind of like a gradient scale of, if prose is using the written word using common language, is the idea of someone who is a prose snob wants prose that's written in the common language of ages past, and that would be kind of purple prose.
Yes. So you're onto actually a couple of really important ideas there, Richard. So the first one is one reason Shakespeare's prose, and by the way, he often wrote in a poetic form. A lot of his lines in his plays, particularly when the nobles are speaking, it's actually iambic pentameter. So it has a very particular rhythm. When the lower class characters or the common characters are speaking, it's just ordinary prose. It feels fancy to us because a lot of those words have fallen out of the language. He uses words like thou and stuff like that, which we no longer have, right? But to people back then, in the 16th, 17th century, those were ordinary words. They weren't fancy words. So yes, Shakespeare's writing was much more accessible in his own time period. That said, he was very creative. You mentioned how he makes up a lot of words. He was very artistic in his prose, let's say. He was very poetic in his prose, which is why I mentioned these definitions are very imperfect, because you have writers who tend, we'll talk about this probably later when we talk about maybe particular fantasy writers, but some writers tend to be more poetic or artistic in their writing. And that's where maybe some people would say, oh, that's too fancy, or that's purple prose or something like that. That makes me think too much. I don't like it. Whereas other authors tend, and it's really a spectrum. I want to emphasize that. It's not an either or, right? And I'm not saying that one is good or bad either, by the way, because there are legitimate purposes for writing language that is a little bit more frilly or poetic or artistic. And then there are good reasons for writing in a style that does stick closer to everyday modern language, which is much more accessible, is much more easily, like, say, if you're a plot driven writer, okay, you want the prose to be a vehicle for the plot, to drive that plot along as fast as you as a reader can go. So this, it's a page turner. Then you're not going to want to be too fancy. You're want to keep it more like the everyday language, because that's a lot easier for the reader to process. Whereas if you're trying to explore things more artistically, maybe you're not concerned about moving that plot along real fast, then, you know, you're free to use more complex language. You're free to use more metaphors. You're free to be creative with your words, like Shakespeare was, and get people thinking, I just saw something I hadn't seen before because he used that word that way. You know, that's a different experience. Both are legitimate experiences. It's not that one is good or bad. But they both have purposes.
I have two examples for that, actually. I was going to throw in some paragraphs or some really short lines where perfect prose, you can pontificate a little bit more. Then you have your more simple lines where you can, you know, say thing a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
So I have one example here from F. Scott Fitzgerald, which this is just a great two-liner that hits hard. And here's the quote. "I don't want to repeat my innocence. I want the pleasure of losing it again." It's just a nice, thoughtful line that makes you go, okay. Makes you think, nothing crazy. There's nothing purple about it. And then you have from the book, This Is How You Lose the Time War, which, have you read that, Philip?
I have not read that one. Yeah.
This doesn't spoil anything for the way. It's just a line. It's very poetic. It's got a lot of purple prose, and it's a love story. And so here's a paragraph from that book to give an example we could talk about.
Okay.
And it's very descriptive of a love story. So prefacing with that. "I want to be a body for you. I want to chase you, find you. I want to be eluded and teased and adored. I want to be defeated and victorious. I want you to cut me, sharpen me. I want to drink tea beside you in 10 years or 1,000. Flowers grow far away on a planet they'll call Cephalus, and these flowers bloom once a century when the living star and its black hole binary enter conjunction. I want to fix you a bouquet of them, gathered across 800,000 years so you can draw our whole engagement in a single breath, all the ages we've shaped together."
Wow. Well read. Well read.
Well written. So yeah. the difference is there, not to and obviously F. Scott Fitzgerald has his lines as well, but to go a difference there. One seems to really make you just feel and use his metaphor analogy. The prose is talking about one thing, but expands and expands and expands. Whereas another line can give you it doesn't use any word that we wouldn't be familiar with, but can still hit just as hard. And my question, kind of going off of that in your comments there, is really just going, hey, can good writing versus bad writing, how objective can we be when we're saying this is good or this is bad? What are your thoughts on that? Because Rich and I, we did a whole episode on objectivity versus subjectivity in art. So I guess since we're talking about what's good and bad in writing, can we even say one thing's better than the other?
Yeah, I'm wary of using words like good and bad, but I do think that you can tell that there are certain writers who've really worked hard on their craft and that they're pushing the boundaries with their word choice. I mean, look, I could say that if somebody were to write a sentence like, I don't know, "he perambulated to the mercantile establishment." Okay.
What did you just say?
Yeah. That just means he walked to the store.
Oh.
Now, why would I do that? Why would I say he perambulated to the mercantile establishment as opposed to he walked to the store? Why would I want to do something like that to a reader, right?
To show off your vocabulary.
That's one reason. That's one possible reason. Or maybe I have a character who's a snob and I want to show my reader, hey, this guy's kind of a pretentious snob. I put that in the dialogue, you know. So it's purple prose is a phrase we use that tends to be derogatory. And I personally feel that it's a phrase that is probably overused, actually. I think a lot of times people will say, that's purple prose, because maybe they have a hard time figuring out what it means. Maybe there are words in there that annoyingly they don't know the meaning of yet. And it just makes it hard to understand. There is, I think, a place for that phrase. There, it is possible to overdo it, guys. I mean, you can try to squeeze in too many metaphors in one sentence, and it almost makes fun of itself, doesn't it?
Right.
When you go too far. And that's what I think of as purple prose. But there, you know, and it is, as you say, there's this whole subjectivity, objectivity thing. Again, I like my spectrums, I guess, but I think that if it's more helpful to think of this as a spectrum where completely subjective is saying, I like this story, therefore it's good, right? That's pretty much, it's a simple, I like it, so it's good. That's completely subjective. Mm-hmm. Or I didn't like this book, so it's bad, right? That's completely subjective. I don't think when you're talking about books that you can be completely objective. I don't think that's actually possible for anyone. However, you can learn to analyze stories in such a way that you can achieve on this spectrum somewhere closer. I forget which way my hands are going here. Somewhere closer to, I'm looking at myself the opposite of what I'm doing here.
Yeah, yeah.
So my brain has
it is confusing.
Little, stage left.
Yeah. So my brain, or not my brain, but in the case of I'm trying to achieve more objectivity, I can learn stuff about how to analyze stories, such as, okay, what can I do in terms of characters? What can I talk about in terms of setting? What can I learn about? I can learn about metaphors. What can I learn about prose and complexity in sentence form and varying your sentences and seeing that this author has really paid attention to their craft and they've worked hard on this and they've made it artistic, you know, and maybe if it's a fantasy author, the author uses language that conjures a different world because there are some archaic language in there, or there's just a different way of speaking. And I get that from the way it's written. Whereas maybe this other author isn't trying so hard and is using a more everyday language that maybe somebody from New Jersey could be using. Right. Maybe there's a place for that too. If you're writing a fantasy that's a satire, or if you're writing a cozy fantasy and you don't want your reader to necessarily feel like this is some ancient different culture or something like that, there can be reasons for any number of different choices here. But I do think of it more as a spectrum myself. Yeah.
Can I jump in on a little bit of our thoughts on this?
Go ahead.
Before we move on to the next topic, because.
Yeah.
Rich and I, when we were doing our episode, I don't know about you, Rich, but we came almost to a conclusion with that prose, and I think we're both getting at the same thing here, Philip, with what you're saying, of prose, you know, this spectrum you're talking about, what was good, what is bad. It's hard when you talk in the macro of writing, prose, what's good and bad. But then if you and I were having a conversation, we say, okay, let's take a category of prose. Let's say, which one is more comprehensible? Which one can you read? Does it like literally use bad grammar? When you take it as micro as possible and go, hey, this one is objectively more fast-paced and this one's longer. Doesn't mean one's good or bad, but when we get into all the minuscule and the micro and we go, okay, this prose, we can objectively measure that it does this craft type thing better, whatever, fill in whatever thing we're analyzing, which doesn't therefore make it better than the other thing, just goes, hey, this is one technique we're analyzing. And reason I'm going into that because Rich, when we were having that conversation of kind of looking at what is good, what is bad writing, when we rate prose for a book, Rich and I, the thing you first mentioned was style. A good definition that Rich and I use in our head, and it's this is just how we do it when we're conveying to people, is how irreplaceable is that author's style? Like, are they the only one that can kind of do it and do their thing.
Do other people now want to emulate that style? Will someone be as, that's a Sanderson light. Mm-hmm. You know, that person writes like Sanderson. That person writes like a Tolkien.
Pratchett prose, Tolkien
Pratchett
prose.
When the prose itself becomes a style.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good indicator.
Style is an important element of prose. I would say it that way. Yeah. Yeah. You guys are absolutely. Yeah. I think you're right. We are on the same page here.
Okay.
There is an element to prose that I look for, at least when what I consider very good or what I personally think is good. And it's a scale balance between length and value of what's given.
Uh-huh.
So
to
me on value is how much are you doing? So a single paragraph you can choose to use that paragraph to just tell more of the plot and things are happening. You could use that same paragraph to tell, to describe the world and give us more of the setting. You can right. give us a great line of dialogue that actually does a great job of giving us more about the characters. There's all these yep. different aspects. Yep. What I would consider great prose mm-hmm. is you doing more than one thing all at once. So the most value for the shortest time. And so if an the reason why I consider Terry Pratchett one of the best, having some of the best prose that I've ever read, is yeah. he's able to, in like the same line of dialogue, tell me more about the character, push the plot further, I'm getting more knowledge, describing the world in a new setting where I'm now seeing more of this world. Right. And then also, of course, learning more about the characters, and I'm maybe making me laugh too, an emotional impact there. If you're able to do all those things in a few lines all at the same time, that's what I consider great prose. What are your thoughts on that kind of definition or that kind of scale?
Well, you're actually getting onto some really important topics there, because when we talk about prose, and specifically fiction prose, because mm-hmm. nonfiction is also consists of prose, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But it's probably in general the least poetic kind of prose you can find. Whereas fiction, you'll find a broader range. Again, some authors like to be more poetic than others, but there are different types of things you're doing when you're writing, when you're using prose. One is description. And you mentioned some of these already, but description is when you're maybe portraying a landscape or you're giving the reader some very direct context about what's in front of the characters and the story, what they're witnessing. You're pausing a bit to describe the surroundings, okay? And there used to be, I think, a greater tolerance for description than often today you'll find, especially in genre fiction, less description than there used to be. Because readers have a tendency to want the story to move along. We don't have to get into all of this, but I think the screen screens have had a lot of influence on that, probably. Movies and films and television shows and whatnot. But anyway, description's still essential in mm-hmm. in written storytelling. Exposition is another thing. And often people will refer to this as info dumping. But really, there is a place for exposition as well. And it is something that I think, again, modern readers tend to dislike when they see it. But you can still skillfully include it in a story without maybe even readers realizing that that's exposition sometimes. You know, if you can work right. it into some dialogue. As you were saying, Terry Pratchett is good at doing these things simultaneously. And that's what good writers can do. But you do need some exposition, and that's where you step back from the story and you're actually explaining, you're giving information. So maybe the characters in the story are walking up to a castle, and I've been describing the castle, what it looks like, what the stone, the color of the stone, how and everything else. But then when I start talking about how it was built 500 years before the present of the story and how many laborers were involved in it and blah, 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 then I'm doing exposition. I'm moving back away from the story. And I'm explaining things that are outside of the immediate present of the story. Does that make sense?
Do you think with the advice that writers often give, if show don't tell, can sometimes be taken too far? Because you have to tell in a story at some
point.
You can't show yep. like every movement, and it gets grueling, right? Example, Guy Gevrey. Okay, we're reading Lions of El Rasan right now.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
Masterful prose, and he will give you exposition, a lot of exposition, and it's just yeah. delightful.
It's a wonderful aside, especially it's fun. It's yeah. a fun pause from the story to go.
Yeah.
It's a lot faster also to just
yeah.
for him info. To explain yeah. it rather than give us a, you know, some flashback scene of like actually showing us what happened in the past. Instead, he just uh-huh. tells us in a wonderful way, which takes yeah. a paragraph versus a whole chapter.
Right. And so that thing you're getting at with them, you're talking about, hey, explanations, exposition. Yep. What advice would you have there? Like, what can make it good? Like, that's not a necessarily bad thing. You need to tell the reader some things.
Yeah, absolutely. I think show don't tell is a good general rule, but you can take it too far. Absolutely. And sometimes you actually do want to tell, and that's okay. And exposition does have a place. When I'm reading a series right now, I'm in is R. Scott Baker's Second Apocalypse. He does a lot of exposition. He does it beautifully. So I don't mind when he does it. But yeah, it has a place. We call it lore sometimes when we're fantasy readers, right? We're getting some lore in there, and that's adding some layers to the world. And I think some fantasy readers appreciate that. So yeah, there's a place for it. But again, it can be done clumsily. And you know, even if you try to insert it in the middle of dialogue, you've got two characters talking about the evil bad guy or something, and oh, he's the one who took over the kingdom 200 years ago when he killed, and it can get really obvious that you're trying to dump information there. That's not good, right? So you have to, I think, learn how to weave it in a little bit there. Yeah. But
what is the right place? Because we're talking about like there is a place for it. What is that right place? And when can it go too far? What's a good indicator, I guess, of, oh, you're doing too much explaining or you're doing too much showing?
Yeah. Well, there are right places, I would say. There's no one right place necessarily to do it. But I tend to feel that if you're in the middle of, let's say, an intense action scene, bad time, right, to do something like that. Dialogue is often a place where you can do it subtly if you're willing to do it in little bits. Don't feel like you have to give everything to the reader at once. So one of the things, one of the little, not a secret, but one of the things I think you can work on is being patient as a writer and realizing, okay, I can reveal this here, and then later on I can reveal this other thing, and it can even be fun for the reader to gradually put this together. You know, that's just sort of general advice, I think, but it's not that, you know, this is the exact right place within the story to do it. But, you know,
you don't want the reader to notice they're being info dumped as much.
Yeah.
Is that a fair assessment? Because
if they notice, they're not going to notice it for too long.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because with Fourth Wing, have you read Fourth Wing, Philip?
No, I haven't.
we did.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the main character has a coping mechanism where she info dumps in her head when she's stressed, essentially. Just a show, because we're talking good, bad writing. Maybe it's just more of a noticeable, like, oh, okay, obvious what character's doing. So it seems like a less tactful way of providing that info. So I gotta be fair. We gotta use good and bad examples. Give some examples out there of bad prose, and also not to say like, hey, some people will enjoy that prose, but when we're talking about the craft itself and info dumping,
well, there's also the idea of people can enjoy a book, even if you could consider it has bad prose. Well, maybe it has really good characters and great plot. So it's, you know, people can like books for a multitude of different reasons.
Yeah, this is one thing in fantasy, right? Where Philip, I'm sure you know this, where Sanderson will have a reputation for having like just lackluster prose compared to your Patrick Rothfuss or your
agreeing. I think the way that Sanderson talks about it himself makes it pretty clear.
Oh yeah,
he talks about transparent prose. I believe that's the way he puts it. So it's obvious to me that Sanderson knows what he's talking about when he talks about transparent prose. He's talking about prose that is accessible. He has chosen as an author to tell his story in a manner that will be not difficult to follow what's happening. In other words, like I was saying earlier, he wants you to be able to follow the plot pretty without too much difficulty and get immersed in his story. And I think he reaches a broader audience that way, actually.
Definitely.
Very, very strategic on his part. I know it is. He expresses a lot of admiration for writers like Guy Gavriel Kay, which you're reading, and you know very well, since you're reading Guy Gavriel Kay, that Kay has a different approach to his prose, where he chooses to be a little more poetic. He uses he inserts more metaphors in there, or, you know, a slightly more archaic language. And I don't think that either approach is bad, actually. I think that, you know, they have different goals in mind.
Right.
And I think that Brandon Sanderson knows very well what he's doing when he makes his prose, as he puts it, transparent. But I would say that Sanderson's a great example of an author who is more on that end of the spectrum within fantasy that is more close to the everyday, you know, sort of language. Whereas Guy Gabriel Kay is over here, he's much more poetic in his prose, let's say. You guys agree with that?
Well, definitely. There's also something interesting about this of, it's kind of a, can you have good, complex prose without being confusing? Because idea of you can be both accessible and people understand it on one level, but you have such detail with the craft that people who are paying attention get more than one level.
Yeah,
I sorry to bring up Terry Pratchett again. It's the reason he's one of my favorites for this very reason. Great. I think he's very approachable. That you can read it and not confusing at all. It reads pretty straight. I think anyone can enjoy it, but if you pay attention just a little bit further, you can see that some of his jokes have three punchlines in one line. There are multiple jokes in there that if you're really paying attention, or how things are described, if you're paying attention, it's a lot more complex than someone who's just running through it. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering, can you have the best of both worlds of you're being very clear, but also you have kind of a more complex
basically, you get your audience and critic score to be high on Rotten Tomatoes, right? That's what you're looking
good
for.
Analogy. Good analogy. Yeah. I think that's possible. It's very difficult, though, because I think there's a tendency for me anyway. Like, there are a lot of authors that I love. We mentioned, you know, Brandon Sanderson already. Another one that I enjoy that I'm reading right now is Ryan Cahill. I'm reading The Bound and the Broken. His prose is very much on that same end of the spectrum as Brandon Sanderson's. And it's a story that I can easily just find myself immersed in. I don't have to think too hard while I'm reading. And sometimes I really want that kind of experience. Other times I want to read Jenny Wirtz or Steven Erickson, where various parts of my brain are firing while I'm reading this. And I'm really loving the complexity. I'm finding it very stimulating. If you're not accustomed to that, it can feel suffocating, maybe, because you're like, wait, I just want to enjoy the story. Why are you making me think so hard about all this stuff that's going on? And you know,
this podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4. PC and Nintendo Switch.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices. Plus, extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. And up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does this word mean? And, you know, that kind of thing. So I think the more you try to engage with that, obviously, it's like any exercise, right? If I work out in the gym, hopefully I'm going to get stronger, right? If I bench press a little more every week, I'm going to get better at it. Same thing with reading. You know, if you want to challenge yourself and read authors who are writing at a level of complexity that is maybe a little beyond you, you'll grow into it. You absolutely will. That's fun to me. I mean, I think it's great. But again, I like to go back sometimes to a Dresden Files book where I don't have to think so much. I'm just cruising along in the story. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Well, yeah.
Now, to ask you a maybe more pointed question, a better sure. angle is, rather than good and bad, yeah. would you say someone who's going for more poetic prose versus someone who's going for more transparent prose, which one is more impressive in the sense of that? Do you sure. get what I mean? Of like, which one is a
more learned, takes more skill,
yeah. takes more skill. It's something that should be appreciated more than the other, of like, oh, that person really worked harder, or are both hard in their yeah. own way, or is it not equal?
I think it's easier to write in the more everyday type of prose. You don't have to work as hard at it. You could probably find that writers who write that way are more prolific as a general rule. They're able to put out more books, which is also a strategic decision. Whereas the authors who are working on the craft and they're tweaking this, no, this word is better than this word. And, you know, they're mm-hmm. almost torturing themselves, kind of making these sentences better, you know, that takes more time. It takes more time. And so that's in a way, I suppose you could say that's more of a feat. There's a level on which, as I said, you know, if I read Jenny Wirtz or Steven Erickson or Guy Gavriel Kay or Neil Gaiman or Ursula Le Guin, you know, there's a number, Robin Hobb, I'm probably having more stuff going on in my brain as I'm reading that. And that obviously takes more practice to do. Yes, that takes more concerted effort. That takes years of working on your craft. So in a sense, yes, if I'm being honest with you, I would say I am more impressed by an author. Now, it's also much easier to do it badly. Mm. You know, if you can say
it's a risk.
Yeah, you can't fake it, right?
It's really a risk. And you're narrowing your audience as well. Keep that in mind. If you're somebody who's, yes, I want to put 20 years into writing this beautiful book, you know, and I'm going to make it rich and complex, and you're going to alienate some readers who just want to, a popcorn read, which is, again, there's nothing wrong with that. But they're not going to find that as fun, an easier, more accessible book. So there's give and take, pros and cons, you know, but I personally, yes, I do find myself admiring. I will say this too. I think that the authors who take that effort and really work on their craft, and they use it to explore deeper themes in a very explicit way, in a more theme-driven story, as opposed to the plot-driven story, I think those stories do stick with me longer as well. I remember them. I think mm-hmm. about them after I've read them more. So I might say that, yes, I have to work harder to get through those stories, but I reap a bigger reward in the sense that they stay with me. I think about them. They get me to see life differently. Whereas if I'm reading, you know, one of the Dresden Files books, I've read seven of them so far, and they're fun and I had a great time, but I'm not thinking about them, you know, afterwards forever, you know?
Is there a particular author that you tried to emulate your own prose for the Eden trilogy?
Wow. Okay. I think some of this is definitely unconscious, and some of it is conscious for any writer.
Yeah.
We're going to, particularly on the first book, a lot of our biggest, most formative influences are just going to ooze out of us. And, you know, we right. can't help that. So I read a lot of Tolkien when I was young. And some people, I don't think my prose is the same as Tolkien's, but a lot of people have said, oh, it feels a little like Tolkien. And I'm like, yeah, that's
not
great.
A bad thing to hear. I mean,
not the yeah. worst comparison.
Yeah. I read a lot of Le Guin as well. Yeah. And I think she has beautiful prose. I also read, before I started writing, I read A Song of Ice and Fire, you know, or some of the books, whatever was published up to the point when I started writing in 2002, or 2004, 2004. you know, that's different. George R. R. Martin. I think he has good prose too, by the way. But it's more modern, obviously, than both Tolkien and Le Guin. So I would say that my prose is somewhere in between a more modern style and those older influences in many ways.
How did you go about making your own style? Was it combining different styles in your head and just like, you know what, I'm going to be what AI can't do yet, but I'm going to use my human brain to just invent something that's a bit different. Is there a way that you were able to do that?
Yeah. I should say too, you mentioned in the beginning, I'm an English professor. I'm a medievalist actually. So I like old stuff.
Yeah.
And, I'm actually familiar with Old English and Middle English. Shakespeare, by the way, is modern English. It's just early modern English. I like archaic old stuff. So that obviously, I probably nudged me in a certain direction as well. At the same time, though, I wanted to write a story that's accessible for people. So I didn't want to go crazy archaic, right? I don't want to make my story a pain to read for the majority of readers, do I? I think for me, I tried to strike a balance between accessibility and being a little artistic and having fun. And
just what Rich wanted.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
A great balance. Yeah.
Hopefully you find it. So, I mean, everybody has their own perfect, you know, Goldilocks zone, right?
Yeah.
Yours might be different from mine. So,
right.
You know, I may be a reader who likes maybe this end, you know, the more complex end, or maybe a reader who just wants to and this is also important to say, I think an individual reader can appreciate various points on this spectrum, right? You're in the mood for a quick, fun read. So you pick up that kind of book. Whereas if you want it, maybe something a little more challenging that is going to stick with you, then maybe you want to go closer to the other end of that spectrum.
You know, it sounds like this is more of a, depending on the reader, it's kind of like going to the gym. it's a weightlifting thing of the more transparent prose is something for, as an experienced reader can pick that up and enjoy it just as much and get good value out of it.
I think so.
And they can read a bunch of different things. But for a new reader, it's something that's where you should start to get to get to the habit, to get to enjoy some other elements, and then you slowly pick up where sometimes the prose is just not for you because where you are in your reading journey,
right?
It's not there. So something I know of when I started reading more heavily into the fantasy genre.
Yep.
I started the first series I read when beginning my reading journey all over again after college was Stormlight Archive. And basically right after that, in some order, I read Name of the Wind and the entire Wheel of Time. And I know I enjoyed the Wheel of Time as much as I did then, because it was early on into my reading journey. So a lot of these tropes and a lot of the fun things that Robert Jordan does with his writing was fresh and new for me. And it was, but now that I've read other things, I look back and go, okay, it's not as magnificent and complex to me anymore.
Uh-huh.
I still enjoy it. It's still great, but it's where I'm now more and more looking for a harder prose to appreciate, because I've seen things before. It's more of just, once you've seen the same thing over and over again, you start getting pattern recognition, and then it gets dull.
How important in art is novelty? It's why modern art is a thing. I mean, how is just doing something new enough? That's where you kind of get into that. Hey, if you're tired of the old thing, what do you think, Philip? How important is doing something somebody hasn't done before?
Yeah. To keep it centered on prose as well.
I mean,
we can talk about this in terms of prose, I think. It is going to depend on in terms of art and in terms of books, it's going to depend on the reader. I'm sorry to give you all these evasive answers, but
unfortunately, the correct answer almost always is it depends.
Yeah. I see you have Susanna Clarke's Piranesi.
Oh yeah, we do.
Oh, love that.
Love it. Love it.
This is an author who takes a lot of time to write a book. And the reason her books are so good is because she does take a lot of time and she does things that are novel and different and pushes the envelope and uses language beautifully. And I promise you, as much as maybe she's very good at it, she has to work at it. She's had to work hard to get there. Mm-hmm. And you're at a point in your reading journey where you appreciate that more and more, it sounds like to me. And that's wonderful. At the same time, I also love that you can still appreciate something like The Wheel of Time, which I don't think Jordan's prose or Sanderson's prose is bad. There are moments where some of those sword farms are pretty poetic, actually, you know, they're almost haiku-like, I think, you know, yeah. It's not the most complex, thought-provoking necessarily. It's more plot-oriented writing, for sure, I think. You know, they achieve something magnificent in that series. It's some of the most vast world-building you can find anywhere, isn't it? And that would be hard to do if you're trying to be super poetic on every page, right?
Tell that to Tad Williams.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. Or Stephen Erickson.
To be fair, I'm not a big fan of Tad Williams. I think almost really? In that exact aspect where I acknowledge it's really poetic.
Yeah.
But it got in the way for me of like, I didn't enjoy the world.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. It's really hard to enjoy the prose and the exposition that is beautiful about a world that I don't care about. And then it becomes even more boring for me.
Yeah.
It's that risk. If he hooked me more into the world, then that wonderful prose would just elevate it even higher. But if I don't care as much about the world, then the prose is a hindrance to me. It kind of seems like that's the risk, is you can go for this more flowery poetic language. But if you miss out on some of that baser elements, it's going to be a worse result.
It's a balancing act. And as we've observed, one reader is going to be like, I love Tad Williams. That beautiful prose just sucks me right in. Another is going to be like, I just wish he'd get on with the story, you know, you know? And the funny thing is sometimes you come back to it 10 years later and you're like, wow, actually I like this now, you know? It's just, that's how it is, I think. And being open, and it sounds like you're very much like this, being open to that, maybe, you know, coming back to a book that initially you thought, oh, this is so boring. I just wish we could have, what's going on? What's going to happen? You know, can we not take 100 pages to get out of the cozy womb-like, you know, Simon, get going on your adventure, please, you know?
Totally possible that I'll enjoy it whenever maybe. I try and redo it. Because I think Tad Williams is such a staple that I feel like I should give him another shot, especially. Uh-huh. But I will say, I still think of this that original trilogy, the second book is almost irrelevant. I personal opinion aside, we'll come to that.
Says personal opinion aside.
Put that aside.
Besides the book being horrible, let's put aside my opinion, which I just stated.
That's a genuine experience that you had. And, that was how you found that book at the time that you tried to read it. I don't know when that was, there are so many factors here. You know, as a writer, I have this task of trying to put on a page, on a dead tree, right? Symbols that are going to somehow convey this thing that I have in my mind. And when you pick that dead tree up with those symbols on it, and you're reading them, and they're going into your, you know, your brain, or you're listening if you're doing an audiobook or whatever. Yeah, that involves all kinds of things, right? Vibrations of your inner ear, and you know, and sending signals to your brain and all that. What's going on? I don't know what's happening as a writer. What's happening in your brain, and how that my vision emerges within you as a reader. And sometimes that process works really well because the reader's in the right place and time and mood and so many other things. And sometimes there are snags, and if the snags get to be too much of a problem, then it's not going to work that time, you know? So,
to that point, we've been talking about some of the ideas of the excellent pros or the worst. If you were to give your advice to a new author, what elements of prose should be a focus? The basics. To give an example of, you're talking about clarity of where you are, of the, being able to set a proper mental picture where the reader isn't confused about what exactly is happening in the scene. What are some other basic goals, things to, for an author to keep in mind?
I mean, there are authors who are can do that in relatively little space, like Ursula Le Guin, for example. I read her books, and they're very, very concise. They're not that lengthy, and yet somehow, with a minimal number of words, she's able to give me this sense of beauty and allow me to envision this world that I'm in along with the characters. I don't know how she does it. You know, she's still in that sense a mystery to me, one that I deeply appreciate. And then other writers need a little more space to get put the reader in that scene, in that world. And that's just, you know, I think you work on it and try to get better at it. You know, it's difficult. So as a fantasy, in terms of people, you know, trying their hand at fantasy, I mentioned earlier this idea of using a slightly different language from the everyday modern language. You know, I made that example, and that's something there's this wonderful essay by Ursula Le Guin, speaking of her, called From Elfland to Poughkeepsie. I don't know if you guys have read that essay or not, but you can kind of tell from the title of the essay. It's not very long, if anyone out there wants to give it a shot. And I talk about it all the time because it's some of the best advice, in my opinion. But I'm old, so, you know, take it for what it is. In terms of writing fantasy, I would read that essay if I were you, if you want to be a fantasy writer. But basically, she makes this distinction between fantasy writers like Tolkien, for example, who do have they use archaic words, or they use a slightly different syntax at times. But you know, you're not in our world when you're reading Lord of the Rings. You know, you're in Middle Earth, right? Whereas there's a tendency for a lot of younger, maybe, but also just modern fantasy writers to use the modern everyday language of our world, where for me personally, it's a little bit harder for me to feel immersed in that when I keep feeling like this dialogue could be here in New Jersey. You know, I don't feel like I'm in this other world. I feel like I'm in just a white space where I'm talking to I'm hearing these characters talk like they could be my neighbors, you know? So for me personally, and this is very much personal, I think it does take some work to be able to pull that off. Cause again, you can go too far and be ridiculous. It's very easy to overdo it. And that's not something you want to do either. But somehow allow your reader to get immersed in your world by using language that isn't just ordinary, is one thing I would advise someone to try to work on. And that takes time, and it takes a lot of reading. And if you want to see how it's done well, look, George R. R. Martin does it really well, in my opinion. Guy Gavriel Kaye does it beautifully. Tolkien, Le Guin, Jenny Wirtz, these are masters of the craft. And watch what they do, you know, as you read.
Yeah. I mean, even Dr. Seuss, right? When we think back to kids' books, where I guess how important can you tell what good prose is when it's so utterly rereadable? Like, I look to my children's books, I can't remember any phrases or lines other than the pictures. The pictures matter. But with Dr. Seuss, for some reason, the cat in the hat and the green eggs and salmon, I mean, maybe it's cheating into a little bit of poetry because it has rhyme schemes, right?
Yeah.
But I kind of want to reread it. The lines that hit me in books, sometimes it's not just the scene that I want to reread. It's Sorta Kaigan, not spoiling the book, but just has a one-liner at the end where I just go, oh, yeah, that's the line right there that just makes both raises and elevates the emotion of the whole scene. And it's just a line that I love to reread. Like, I will think back to hilarious lines in something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I say this to Rich all the time, but I love the quote. The the ship hung in the sky much in the same way that bricks don't. It's like, it's just a funny line to me. It's so fun because yeah. I can say it over and over again and it still makes me laugh. I don't know how, but something about the prose itself, you being able to go back, reread it, have a memory just of the line. How important is that? And just going, ah, that is good prose. Whereas all the stuff we can't remember and we gloss over was more of a tool, whereas the prose we remember is craft, possibly. I'll hypothesize that.
Yeah. I love what you're saying, Austin. I think that's very perceptive. In terms of Dr. Seuss, what's a Lorax, right? the fact that he makes up words and puts you in different weird worlds,
yeah,
it's like fantasy in that sense. And that's kind of what I was getting at is, look, fantasy is the literature of the imagination, much more so than any other genre. I'm a very proud defender of fantasy. I think it's a beautiful genre because it encourages your imagination to soar like no other genre. And being creative with language is part of that, you know, making up funny words. And sometimes you can kind of make fun of it a little bit, you know, like Terry Pratchett might do sometimes. It can be very satirical. You know, the Color of Magic is a book that essentially is kind of making fun of fantasy in some ways. You know, it's satire on a level. But, you know, in general, though, that creative use of language is something that fantasy just kind of encourages and unleashes. And I love that about fantasy. So, yeah, that's one of the reasons I love the genre.
Absolutely. You just gave me a great thought and the idea, like some of the difference between fantasy and sci-fi.
Yeah.
Of if the purpose of fantasy's prose is to make you believe that it is not our own world. And so you use different language that is made up, the imagined, completely imagined. I think sci-fi is ever so slightly different. Like the ultimate goal of sci-fi is to make you believe that it's not our world, but it's one that could be our world.
It has to be probable. So it's impossible versus probable.
Yeah. Right? The difference, I think that's what I love about some sci-fi books where the prose is done in a way that I believe it could be real and it's the probable. Yeah. And what bothers me sometimes with some sci-fi is it feels too much like magic and it's just, you know, big, the words they actually use. And sorry to hate on your boy.
Don't say it about Pierce. Don't you?
Red Rising.
Oh, here we go. The
thing is, he does so many great things in all the other aspects. This is just a rub for me on the prose for Pierce Brown. Is
okay.
The word choices make it feel more magic-esque rather than a probable world in the future. A difference between Christopher Rocchio and Pierce Brown for me. That's a very particular difference of how does Pierce Brown describe like a sling blade? And it's a lightsaber whip thing and how it's described, it doesn't feel like it's real. It's just complete make-believe versus
page 23. He actually said, lightsaber whip thing. That's what,
that's exactly. But Christopher Rocchio has essentially the same type of device, but he calls it a high matter sword, and the idea going into the detail of
a little more sciencey.
Exactly, the idea that the reason why it acts like a lightsaber is it's, you know, one atom thin. That whole thing, it's not completely original, but it's how it's described to me that's what sci-fi should be.
So you're saying. Pierce Brown feels a little more sci fantasy to you, and Rocchio feels more closer to the hard science fiction side. I haven't read either yet, but
just in terms of prose and the choice of words, where I feel like Rocchio's world is more probable, where Pierce Brown's world is more.
It's more like Star Wars.
As a Pierce Brown apologist, I couldn't agree with that distinction of, Rocchio's is more Dune-esque, whereas Pierce Brown's is more like a typical, more fantasy, sci-fi.
Star Wars.
Sci-fantasy is exactly a good way to put it, Philip. Yeah.
Okay.
But that distinguished with maybe different genres have their different different goals in their prose. So
absolutely.
So precisely with sci-fi and fantasy, and we're not even touching on nonfiction. We're just in fiction and fantasy really here. Yeah. So for us who love lore and those that info where we can let the author get away with those info dumps more if we're really invested and really into it. I mean, is it a bad answer that it comes down to how we feel?
I don't think so. I think it's actually a good answer.
I want to kind of say two things with that. The first on that being, is there just clear if you're saying to somebody, you pick up a manuscript and you go, this is poor writing. Are there things that you can say like, hey, are bad? We're not to name books that are out there, not to bash anybody at all, but hey, general advice, for example, one thing that could be avoided is, you know, avoid repetition when it's not intentional. Maybe that's a good way of saying, okay, if it's not actually there intentionally and you said the same word and it, like, I already know they're looking up in the sky, then you said they're looking again. You said they're looking and gazing, but you didn't mean to. Something like that. Or do you have other type of writing advice where you'd say, hey, avoid this for the newbies here, for somebody that wants to write a book, what should they try to do or avoid?
Yeah. I mean, repetition is a great example. Try to have some variation in your sentences, including in their length. If you have a bunch of sentences that are exactly the same in length and structure in a row, it gets monotonous. So be conscious of that. Hey, I just wrote three long sentences. Maybe I should have a short, snappy one right now, you know, and you can be strategic about that, you know. So think about things like sentence length. Think about how many times have I just used this word in the last three pages? Maybe I should find a synonym, you know. Don't write with your thesaurus next to you. That's bad advice.
On that, a lot of people think they have to have a lot of different forms of said, like person said, person replied, retorted, person. But it's not, sometimes it's a good thing to just use said a couple more times than that.
You can simply have the character do some kind of action.
Yeah, yeah.
And then just put the dialogue right after that action. And then the reader knows it's that character who's speaking, right? So there are a lot of clues. You can avoid the word said even altogether. I think a lot of the times for me, as I'm editing my own writing, it's a matter of taking out the bad stuff in order to make it as good as I can. But it's also a matter of often trimming it. Let's put it that way, trimming it. I often find that I use adverbs where I actually don't need, the adverb doesn't add any meaning to the sentence. I take it out and the sentence feels just a little bit more sharp, but also accessible. Like that's one less word the reader has to imbibe, and it just makes it easier on the reader. So these are all things you consider when you're writing try to have variety in there, both on in terms of the level of the word usage, but on the level of the sentence, even the level of the paragraph. I would say if you have three long paragraphs in a row, maybe you should think about having a short paragraph in there. But
how do you split up your paragraphs? Is it just by general thought, by when it feels right?
Yeah, it depends on the situation. If it's a passage of dialogue, it's really easy. You know, you switch from one character to another. Usually you start a new paragraph. That's how that works. But if I'm doing a more descriptive passage, then I try to describe maybe a particular part of what the character is witnessing. And if I move on to, if I zoom out or in, or if I move to a different part of what they're witnessing, then I start a new paragraph, right? So it really depends on the context. Action, shorter paragraphs. If you're doing action, you want shorter sentences usually and shorter paragraphs. So it depends on what you're trying to convey to the reader too. If your action is a good place to really pare it down often. That's not to say you can't have one really long sentence though. I mean, again, variety is important. So don't have just a bunch of short sentences in a row, you know. But when you want something really to hit, sometimes just having a three word sentence in the midst of a really important action scene can really, you know, work well. Just being conscious of that. And what I tend to do is I write something and I just accept that it's going to be garbage. And then the next day, the first thing I do is I go over what I wrote the previous day and I just edit and edit and edit. And if I have time, I move on to the next passage and I work on that. And the next day I'll start editing what the fresh stuff, right? I'll go back and everybody has their own way of doing it, but it's just very important. What I'm trying to say is it's really important to edit and go back to your writing. Sometimes it's better to give it some time, let it sit for a while, and then you come back to it and you see all the dumb stuff you did much more clearly, almost like it was somebody else who wrote it.
Do you know when you hit something? Do you know, like, oh, that was a good line?
I absolutely have felt that. Yeah. Ahead, yeah. And when readers say, I love this passage, I was like, yes.
I totally didn't spend 1 week on that one line.
Yeah, there are moments, I think a lot of people who write will say this, when you're in the midst of the creative process, there are moments when you just kind of know that you're not writing anymore. The story is just, you're channeling the story. Right. Does that make sense? When it's just flowing out of you and you're not even thinking anymore. It's just like you're in that flow state and you realize later on, wow, that, I don't know where that came from, somewhere deep down or from the cosmos or whatever, but man, that's the best thing I've written so far, you know? Wow. And I think the more you attempt to write, the more likely you'll have that experience. But yeah. And then there are days when you write and you go back and you look at it and you think, what was I thinking? You know?
And that's the disadvantage of being a critic. People spend all this time working on their craft. And Rich and I come on, prose 3 out of 5 star.
It was okay. It
wasn't for me.
Neutral. I may have spent a year on it, but you know, it's okay.
I gotta say, after talking to you now, I really want to read your book. This is, I'm so curious, and you've done a great job. I love your cover as well, the stained glass mosaic, which in a way is just how Brandon Sanderson's
seems appropriate.
What's that? I have no idea what Rich is about to do. He's going, that is appropriate, actually. He's getting a poster in our corner.
Oh, cool. Cool, cool.
It's actually, are you telling me
that display, be very happy with us.
Ooh.
They have posters now with like kind of ridge edges and shiny nature where it kind of emulates stained glass. Super cool. Anyway, display, you're welcome. Free that's little awesome. Ad for them.
You got at least something to use code TutorRamble at checkout. So help.
Look
someone.
At us being proper podcasters.
It looks beautiful. I love it.
It really reminds me of your cover, and they're very curious to read that. And Philip,
anyone's curious, this is the cover in question.
Yes,
I think.
Yes, the Way of Eden. So cool. So cool.
Yeah, stained glass. Yeah,
stained glass. Yes.
So. And yeah, thank you. Yeah, I actually asked for that. That was sort of my idea. That's as much credit as I can take. I had the idea for stained glass because it is the backdrop is a holy war. So religion plays a big role in the trilogy, and having the stained glass window is kind of a nod to that. So that's part of the reasoning there is for that. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Philip, thank you so much for diving into good and bad writing with us. I would be honored to end us with a quote and just see what we all feel about it, you know, because I was really coming down to the prose is how it makes you feel. Writing's how it makes you feel. And this is possibly I haven't even read Narnia. Okay. But this is possibly my favorite quote. And are you familiar with the dedication to his goddaughter, Lucy? That C.S. Lewis gave to Lucy, are either of you?
I have read, Narnia, and I believe I recall that dedication.
It's just extremely touching. This just shows to me it can be very simply put and still just strike an emotional chord. And this is C.S. Lewis putting a dedication in Narnia to his goddaughter, Lucy. And he says this, "My dear Lucy, I wrote this story for you, but when I began it, I had not realized that girls grow quicker than books. As a result, you are already too old for fairy tales, and by the time it is printed and bound, you will be older still. But someday, you will be old enough to start reading fairy tales again. You can then take it down from some upper shelf, dust it, and tell me what you think of it. I shall probably be too deaf to hear and too old to understand a word you say, but I shall still be your affectionate godfather." It gets me every single time. It's just, don't grow up, Lucy, don't. And I think we talk a lot on our channel about why stories hit us and the characters, the plot, like your world first, Rich, I'm character first. Everybody has their thing, but none of these stories hit without a delivery. without the prose itself. So I think we overlook it a lot. So I'm glad we talked about this so that for our future reviews, we'll pay more attention to it and pay more attention to you, your books, everything. Thank you so much, Philip, for coming on.
Oh, thank you guys for inviting me. You know, as Ursula Le Guin says in that essay from Elfland to Poughkeepsie, the prose is the story. So it is something that people, whether they realize it or not, probably do care about. And the more you learn about it, the more you study it, the more you see how important it is for storytelling. But thank you both. I really enjoyed this a lot. It was fun to meet you and chat with you. We're all in the same boat here. We're passionate fans of fantasy and of storytelling. And it's so cool when we can come together like this and share ideas and enrich each other. So I really appreciate you both.
Thanks so much. Thanks I appreciate you too. I'll add you in that. I said to Philip, but you're fine too. All right.
Yeah, it's fine.
All right, that's the episode.
Hey, if you want to find Philip Chase, his channel will be in the description below. Also, where else do you want them to find you?
Oh, well, I'm not terribly findable anywhere else, but other than I'm on Twitter X or whatever it's called now. I'm Philip Chase 90 over Philip Chase 90 on X. That's pretty much the only other social media platform that I putter around in, I guess, besides YouTube. But yeah.
Awesome. Right. Everybody go check him out.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.